the winged babies perched on pillars throughout the house. Their eyes were as lifeless as marbles. Maria bounced around the room, talking animatedly. Matt couldn't hear what she said, but there was no question she was giddy with excitement. That was the difference between her and everyone else, he thought. She was overflowing with life. Everything delighted or devastated or fascinated her. There was no middle ground. Next to her, Emilia looked faded, and Fanny, who was drinking out of a brandy bottle in the corner, was positively drab. The bodyguards turned up the sound. Matt heard the wedding march, and Senator Mendoza took Emilia by the arm. The Egypts lifted the train, and Maria and Fanny took their places behind the bride. They left the room with a stately, impressive walk. A whisper passed over the crowd, and the priest signaled everyone to stand. Stephen waited at the altar with Benito and Tom. Tom. For a moment, all Matt could see was his lying face. What you saw was not what you got with him. Underneath that angelic exterior was the boy who'd shot a helpless child with a pea shooter, who had pulled chairs out from under El Viejo, who'd nailed frogs to the lawn so they could be devoured by herons. You didn't want to leave anything vulnerable around Tom. A bodyguard blocked Matt's view for a moment. He cursed under his breath. The next thing he saw was Emilia approaching the altar on her father's arm. Maria had a tight grip on Fanny to keep her from swaying. Benito's wife was almost as loaded as Felicia, who was being held upright by Mr. Alagran. What a family, thought Matt. The women were alcoholics, Benito was as dumb as a guppy, and Tom was a moral black hole. Stephen was okay, though. Even the Alagrans couldn't strike out 100% of the time. Now, Emilia was given away by her father. Stephen placed a ring on her finger and lifted her veil for a kiss. They were married, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, till death should them part. But maybe they wouldn't have to part, Matt thought. Maybe they'd all waft up to heaven together, to a special wing reserved for the Alagrans. They'd have mortal crabs and caramel pudding, and a vat full of whiskey for Felicia.
Bloody hell! It's the old vampire! Swore one of the bodyguards.
Matt pressed his eye to the peephole. He was so startled, he dropped the telescope. He saw, far away, but hideously clear, El Patron jerk upward in his wheelchair. The old man clutched his heart and tipped forward. Tamlin scrambled to catch him. Mr. Alagran yelled for help. Willem and several other doctors who had recently taken up residence in the house shoved their way through the crowd. They knelt around El Patron, completely hiding the old man. They reminded Matt of vultures huddling over an antelope. Bodyguards streamed out of the machine room, and a moment later, Matt saw them on the screens. They rushed into the salon and herded the wedding guests out. Tamlin suddenly rose from the huddle with El Patron in his arms. Matt saw with horror how small and withered the old man was. He looked like a dry leaf clutched to the bodyguard's chest as Tamlin hurried out with the doctors in his wake. The salon was deserted, except for Stephen and Emilia, who were standing alone and forgotten at the altar. Chapter 22. Betrayal. What should I do? What should I do? Whispered Matt, hugging himself and rocking back and forth in the dark passageway. He loved El Patron. He wanted to be with him at the hospital, to watch over him and urge him back to health. But at the same time, Matt remembered Maria saying that she did know the source of El Patron's transplants, and it's evil. Celia would be looking for him. Unbidden, another memory surfaced. Celia was fussing with the suit Matt had worn to the birthday party long ago. If anything bad happens, she had said, I want you to come straight to me. Come to the pantry behind the kitchen. What do you mean bad? Matt had asked. I can't say. Just promise me you'll remember. And even longer ago, Matt remembered Tamlin speaking to him soon after his rescue from Rosa. I'll tell you this. El Patron has his good side and his bad side. Very dark indeed is his majesty when he wants to be. When he was young, he made a choice, like a tree does when it decides to grow one way or the other. He grew large and green until he shadowed over the whole forest. but most of his branches are twisted. So many hints. So many clues. Like a pebble that starts an avalanche, Matt's fear shook loose more and more memories. Why had Tamlin given him a chest full of supplies and maps? Why had Maria run from him when they found McGregor's clone in the hospital? Because she knew. They all knew. Matt's education and accomplishments were a sham. It didn't matter how intelligent he was. In the end, the only thing that mattered was how strong his heart was. And yet Matt wasn't quite sure. What if he was wrong? What if El Patron really loved him? Matt thought about the old man lying on a hospital bed, waiting for the one person who could bring him a glimpse of his youth. It was too cruel. Matt curled up on the floor of the passage. He lay in a welter of fine dust that had drifted into this dark, secret space over the years. He felt like the inhabitant of an ancient tomb, an Egyptian pharaoh or Chaldean king. El Patron loved to talk about such things. The old man enthusiastically described the wealth that filled the pyramids for the use of the old kings in their afterlife. He liked the tombs of the ancient Chaldeans even more. Not only did they have clothes and food, but their horses were slaughtered to provide transport in the shadowy world of the dead. In one tomb, archaeologists had discovered soldiers, servants, and even dancing girls laid out as though they were sleeping. One girl had been in such a hurry, the blue ribbon she was meant to wear in her hair was still rolled up in her pocket. What a fine thing that was, El Patron had told Matt, that a king got to rule in this life, but also had his entire court to serve him in the next. That was even better than El Dorado powdered with gold on the balcony of his great house. Matt choked on the dust and sat up to clear his throat. He didn't want to make any noise. He didn't want anyone to find him until he'd decided what to do. He leaned against the wall, and the darkness outside was equaled by the darkness inside his mind. What was he to do? What could he do? Footsteps running up the passage made him jump to his feet. He saw a flashlight bobbing in front of a slight figure. Maria, he whispered.
Oh, thank heavens. I was afraid you'd gone somewhere else to hide, she whispered back.
Hide, he said.
They're looking for you, everywhere. They tore up Celia's apartment, and they've been through every room in the house. They've sent bodyguards to comb the stables and fields.
Matt held her by the shoulders and looked closely at her face. In the dim light, he saw her face was wet.
Why are they looking for me? You have to know. Tamlin said you were too clever not to figure it out.
Matt felt turned to stone. The bodyguard evidently gave him more credit than he deserved. Matt hadn't figured it out, not really, until a few minutes ago.
I'm supposed to be throwing a hysterical fit in my room. Emilia says I'm always getting hysterical. She says you're only the latest edition of Furball, but she's wrong. You're not a dog. You're so much, much more.
Ordinarily, Matt would have been thrilled by Maria's words, but the situation was too dire for happiness.
Tamlin says you're to stay put for now. He's going to spread a rumor that you've taken a safe horse north to the United States. He says that should keep the farm patrol busy.
Matt felt dazed by all that was happening. He couldn't seem to get his mind working.
How's it, Patron? He asked.
Why do you care?
Maria said passionately. You should pray that he dies.
I can't, murmured Matt.
And it was true. No matter how treacherous El Patron had been, Matt loved the old man. No one was closer to him in the whole world. No one understood him better.
You're exactly like Tamlin, said Maria. He says El Patron is like a force of nature, a tornado or volcano or something. He says you can't help being awestruck even when you might get killed. I think it's all rubbish.
What am I supposed to do? Matt said. He felt drained of willpower.
Stay here. I'll go throw the hysterical fit everyone's expecting. When it gets dark, I'll come back for you.
Where can we go? Said Matt. He could think of only the oasis, but it was a long way without a safe horse to carry them.
To Dada's hovercraft, said Maria.
Matt's eyes widened. You know how to fly?
No, but the pilot was going to take me back to the convent after the wedding. I told him to expect us.
How will you explain me?
You're my new pet Egypt. Emilia has a dozen, and I told the pilot I was jealous and demanded one of my own.
Maria had to cover her mouth to keep the giggles from spilling out into the dark passage.
Nobody ever asks questions about Egypts. They're just part of the furniture.
Matt slept most of the time he was waiting. He was tired from the illness that had come over him recently and exhausted by all that had happened. He woke, parched and thirsty, and realized he had no water. The passageway was dry and dusty. Matt swallowed, trying to soothe his burning throat. His throat hurt all the time these days, with or without water. He found the machine room stuffed with bodyguards. Every view screen was being watched, and Matt realized there wasn't a single safe place in the house. He couldn't go out for water. He began to worry about Maria. How had she gotten past them before, and how would she get back in? He leaned against the wall, sunk in the deepest despair. Time passed slowly. Matt thought about the lemonade Celia always left in the fridge. He imagined the juice sliding down his throat. Then, because the air had grown cooler, he thought about hot chocolate instead. Celia made it with cinnamon. One of his earliest memories was of her hands holding a cup to his lips and of a wonderful spicy aroma swirling around his head. Matt swallowed painfully. It didn't help to think about drinking when you couldn't do it. Long ago he'd seen a dead Egypt in the poppy fields. Tamlin said the man had died of thirst. Matt wondered how long it had taken. He heard footsteps. He sprang up and was immediately swept with dizziness. He must be more dehydrated than he thought.
I'm sorry. I forgot about water.
Maria thrust a bottle at him and Matt snatched it and drank ravenously.
How's el patrón?
He asked after he drained the bottle.
Better, unfortunately.
You sound like you don't want him to get well.
Of course I don't.
Keep your voice down, said Matt. If he lives, I can come out.
No, you can't. He needs a new heart if he's going to survive. And there's only one place to get it.
Matt put his hand out to keep from swaying. It was one thing to understand his fate, and very different to hear Maria say it out loud.
El patrón loves me, he said.
Maria made a small, impatient noise.
He loves what you can do for him. We don't have time to waste. Here's an Egypt uniform to wear. Tamlin got it for me. Remember, you can't say a word if we meet anyone.
Matt quickly changed clothes. The uniform reeked of sweat and a chemical odor that awoke evil memories in Matt. The wastelands, he thought. The person who wore this had lain in the fields on still nights, when the air near the Egypt pens had gone bad.
Here's your hat, said Maria.
She led him through the passage. They were moving away from the music room and past El Viejo's old apartment. Matt wondered who was living there now, or if perhaps it had been sealed up. A lot of the mansion was, but you couldn't count on a place being empty. They came to a stretch where Matt had been unable to find a peephole. Maria shone the flashlight along the wall. There's nothing here, Matt said.
Wait.
She slid a piece of red plastic over the flashlight. The walls turned the color of dried blood. It made the place look darker and more sinister. The air suddenly seemed stale, like a tomb that hadn't been opened for a very long time.
There, cried Maria.
In the middle of the wall, where Matt could have sworn nothing had been a minute ago, was a red, glowing patch. He bent close. The patch disappeared.
You're in the beam, said Maria.
Matt stepped back, and the patch appeared again. It reminded him a little of the stars Celia had pasted on his bedroom ceiling. It was a different color, though, and it wasn't a star.
It's a scorpion, he cried.
The mark of the Alacrangs, said Maria. Tamlin told me about it. It shows up only in red light.
What does it mean?
I hope, it's a way out.
Matt put out his hand to touch the scorpion and Maria grabbed his arm.
Wait, I have to explain something. I've been going in and out of this passage from El Patron's bedroom. The view screens can't see in there, according to Tamlin, but they can watch everything around it. You couldn't escape from there.
Matt was hypnotized by the red scorpion. It seemed to shimmer with a life all its own.
This is another way out, said Maria. I thought this passage was built so El Patrón could spy on people. Of course, he did spy on people. Tamlin said he called it his private soap opera. But El Patrón really made the tunnel to escape from his enemies. He has a lot of enemies.
I know, said Matt.
The problem is, I don't know whether you want to take the chance.
What? Matt said impatiently.
It works only for El Patrón. That's to keep enemies from sneaking in. When he presses his hand against the red scorpion, the wall opens, and he can get in and out of the house without being seen. The escape route goes to the hovercraft landing field. But if the wrong person touches the scorpion, it sends a lethal jolt of electricity through his arm, and the whole passage fills with a poisonous gas. At least that's what Tamlin says. He hasn't tried it.
Matt stared at Maria. This is your plan to rescue me?
Well, it might work, she said. Tamlin says the scorpion recognizes the fingerprints and DNA of El Patrón, and you're his clone.
Matt suddenly felt lightheaded. She was right. He was El Patrón's clone. His fingerprints would be the same, his DNA identical.
If you're wrong, he told Maria, we'll die. We'll die together, dearest.
Matt's heart jolted when he heard, dearest. I can't let you do it. I'll go alone. I have a secret hiding place.
The Oasis? Said Maria. You'll never make it there ahead of the farm patrol.
So she even knows about that, Matt thought. Tamlin must have told her everything. I can try.
And so can I, she said,
getting that mulish look in her eyes Matt knew so well.
Either you press that scorpion and we escape together, or we stay here and starve together. I'm not leaving you. Not now, or ever.
I love you, Matt said.
I love you too, said Maria. I know that's a sin, and I'll probably go to hell for it.
If I have a soul, I'll go with you, promised Matt. He thrust his hand against the glowing scorpion before he could change his mind. He felt a strange sensation like hundreds of tiny ants crawling up his arm. The hairs on the back of his hand stirred.
Run! It's not working! He yelled.
Instead, Maria grabbed him. A door slid back before them and a long, dark tunnel was revealed.
If we had time to waste, I'd faint,
Maria sighed, shining the flashlight into the new opening. The tunnel smelled even older than the passageway, and it was clear it hadn't been used for a very long time. The floor was packed dirt with a forlorn little heap of soil here and there where some burrowing animal had got in, but there was nothing alive in the tunnel now. Not a mouse, or a spider, or even a toadstool. It gave Matt the creeps. Their footsteps were muffled. The sound of their breathing seemed to die in the cold, lifeless air. It struck Matt that there might not be much oxygen in the tunnel, and he hurried Maria along. After a while, they came to another wall blocking the way. Maria put the red plastic over the flashlight again and revealed another shimmering scorpion. This time, Matt didn't hesitate. He pressed his hand against the wall and felt the same sensation of crawling ants. A second door slid open. This entrance was concealed by thick bushes. Matt carefully pushed them aside for Maria, and they found themselves on the edge of the hovercraft landing field.
That's our ship,
whispered Maria, pointing out a small craft with its landing lights on. She walked ahead, and Matt followed, pulling the broad brim sombrero down to hide his face. They didn't hurry. They looked, Matt hoped, like they had all the time in the world. If bodyguards were watching this part of the house, all they'd see was an honored guest attended by an eejit. Eejits didn't rate any more attention than dogs. Matt was sweating with nerves. It was harder acting brainless than he'd imagined. He wanted to look around, but eejits didn't do such things. He tripped on a rock and caught himself before he actually fell. Mistake, he thought. A real eejit would land flat on his face. Would he yell if he got hurt? Matt didn't know.
Stay, said Maria.
Matt halted. She climbed into the hovercraft and then ordered him to come inside. He heard her talking to the pilot.
Sit,
said Maria, pointing at a chair. She buckled him in and continued chatting to the pilot, telling him about the convent and how glad she'd be to get back.
I'm sorry to bother you, Miss Mendoza, the pilot said with great respect.
but do you have a permit for this Ijit? They're not exactly welcome in Aslan.
The Mother Superior will have one, Maria said airily.
I hope so, said the man. Otherwise, you'll have to be put to sleep. I know a sensitive girl like you wouldn't like that.
Maria turned pale, and Matt realized she hadn't known about this law.
We'll take off as soon as your sister leaves.
My sister? Maria almost shrieked. Stay calm, Matt thought desperately.
You didn't think I'd let you go without saying goodbye, said Amelia, coming out of the cockpit.
Stephen was with her, and so were a pair of bodyguards. Matt sat perfectly still, his head bowed as the bodyguards took up positions in front of the door. He couldn't think of another thing to do.
Amelia, how nice, said Maria without any enthusiasm. I really don't think the Mother Superior wants an Ijit at the convent, Amelia said. Stay out of this. Why should I help you indulge in another do-good project? Honestly, you're the laughingstock of the convent. Like when you wanted to care for lepers, the nuns laughed themselves silly over that. There aren't any lepers in Aslan. They'd have to import them. And now you want to rescue a clone?
Ijit,
Maria said quickly.
Clone, said Stephen, coming forward and pulling off Matt's hat. He dropped it as though he'd touched something foul.
Matt looked up. There was no point pretending now.
I forced Maria to do it, he said.
You've gotten her into trouble for years, said Amelia. From that first day she brought you food, you've exploited her.
He has not, cried Maria.
You're too soft, Amelia said. You're always getting gooey about sick animals or homeless people. If you're not careful, you'll turn out like mother.
Mother, gasped Maria. I haven't told you. I didn't have time. She's alive.
So? Amelia said. I've known that for years.
Maria stared at her sister as though she'd just seen a tarantula.
You knew? Of course. I'm older than you, remember? I saw her go, and Dada shouted that she was dead to us now. It seemed the easiest way to explain things to you.
You let me think she was lost in the desert.
Amelia shrugged. What difference does it make? She didn't care about us.
She thought taking care of losers was more important.
The important thing is to get this clone to the hospital where it can do some good, said Stephen.
Stephen, whispered Matt.
In all this time, he'd thought Stephen and Amelia were, if not his friends, not his enemies either. He admired Stephen. In many ways, they were alike.
Take him, Stephen signaled the bodyguards.
Wait, Maria shrieked. You can't do this. Matt's not an animal.
He's livestock, Stephen said with a cold smile. The law is very clear. All clones are classified as livestock because they're grown inside cows. Cows can't give birth to humans.
I won't let you do this. I won't let you.
Maria threw herself at the guards, and they rather sheepishly ducked their heads to avoid her blows. The pilot grabbed her from behind and pulled her away.
I'll call Willem, Stephen said, heading for the cockpit. I can see we'll need sedatives before we can send her back to the convent.
Amelia, help me. Help him,
screamed Maria, but no one paid her the slightest attention. Matt walked between the bodyguards. He had no hope of fighting them off, and he didn't want Maria's last image of him to be of a terrified farm animal being dragged off to slaughter. He turned to look at her, but she was too busy struggling with the pilot to notice. The bodyguards held Matt's arms, but they didn't insist on carrying him. He smelled the night air, the scent of jasmine and gardenias that had been planted everywhere for the wedding. He smelled the distant odor of the desert, perhaps even of the mesquite surrounding the oasis. Things traveled so much farther at night. He saw the fantastic gardens of the big house, the statues of babies with wings, the orange trees festooned with lights. This was his last night on Earth. And he wanted to remember everything. Most of all, he wanted to remember Celia and Tamlin. And Maria. Would he ever see them again? Or if he was denied heaven, would he wander through the night like La Llorona, searching for something that was forever lost?
Age 14. Chapter 23. Death.
Matt was strapped to a bed in a room full of alarming machinery. Two guards sat outside the door, and another two waited by the window, which was covered by iron bars. He was utterly terrified. This was where they had kept McGregor's clone. This was where the bad things happened. If only I'd escaped when I'd had the chance, he thought. Everything was ready for me. Tamlin gave me maps and food and showed me how to climb mountains. I didn't understand. I didn't want to understand. He was sick with dread. Every noise in the hall made him try to free himself. At one point, Willem and two strange doctors appeared and proceeded to poke Matt's stomach and take his blood. They untied him so he could pee into a bottle, and Matt took the opportunity to run. He got only about 6 feet before being tackled by one of the guards. Fool, 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 Matt told himself. Why didn't I escape when I had the chance? After a while, Willem and the other doctors returned to discuss Matt's health.
It has mild anemia, said one of the doctors. Its liver functions are a little off.
Is it cleared for transplant? Inquired Willem.
I see nothing against it, said the strange doctor, peering at a chart.
They left Matt alone with his fear and his imagination. What was Maria doing now? They would have drugged her, as Fanny had been drugged before she was forced to marry Benito. Perhaps Felicia had been given laudanum in the beginning to keep her obedient. One day there would be another grand wedding for Maria and Tom. Maria would have to be propped up as she walked toward the altar. I can't save her, thought Matt. But perhaps he'd done the one thing that could rescue her. Maria knew about her mother now. She could call for help. And Esperanza, if Matt knew anything about the woman who wrote A History of Opium, would descend on the convent like a fire-breathing dragon. The door opened, and a pair of bodyguards entered and proceeded to untie Matt. Now what? He thought. It couldn't be a good sign. Nothing was good anymore. Not for him. The bodyguards, keeping a tight hold on Matt's arms, led him down the hall to a room unlike any he'd seen in the hospital. It was decorated with fine paintings, elegant furniture, and carpets. At the far end, next to a tall window, was a small table with a teapot, cups, and a silver plate of cookies. And next to it lay El Patrón in a hospital bed. He looked extremely frail, but life still sparkled in his jet-black eyes. In spite of himself, Matt felt a wave of affection.
Come closer, mi vida, said the whispery old voice.
Matt approached. He saw more guards standing in the shadows, and Celia in a beam of light from a gap in the curtains. Matt braced himself for a stormy scene, but she was dry-eyed and grim.
Sit down, mi vida, said El Patrón, indicating a chair by the table. As I remember, you like cookies.
I did when I was 6 years old, thought Matt. What was going on here?
Cat got your tongue, the old man said. It's like the first time we met, when Celia rescued you from the chicken litter.
He smiled. Matt didn't. He had nothing to be happy about.
Ah, well, sighed El Patrón. It always comes to this in the end. My clones forget about the wonderful years I give them. The presents, the entertainment, the good food. I don't have to do it, you know.
Matt stared ahead. He wanted to speak, but his throat had closed up.
If I were like McGregor, a good farmer but a foul human being, I would have had your brain destroyed at birth. Instead, it pleased me to give you the childhood I never had. I had to grovel at the feet of the ranchero who owned my parents' land for every damn sack of cornmeal.
Celia said nothing. She might have been carved out of stone.
But once a year that changed, said El Patrón. During Cinco de Mayo, the ranchero had a celebration. I and my five brothers went to watch. Mama brought my little sisters. She carried one,
and the other held onto her skirt and followed behind. Matt knew this story so well he wanted to scream. El Patrón slipped into it effortlessly, like a donkey walking along a well-worn trail. Once he got going, nothing could stop him until he reached the end. The old man spoke of the dusty cornfields and purple mountains of Durango. His bright black eyes saw beyond the hospital room to the streams that roared with water 2 months of the year and were dry as a bone the rest of the time.
The mayor of our village, dressed in a fine black and silver suit, rode on a white horse and threw money to the crowd. How we scrambled for the coins, how we rolled in the dirt like pigs, but we needed the money. We were so poor we didn't have 2 pesos to rub together. On this day, the ranchero gave a great feast. We could eat all we wanted, and it was a wonderful opportunity for people who had stomachs so shrunken that chili beans had to wait in line to get inside. One year, during that feast, my little sisters got typhoid. They died in the same hour. They were so small, they couldn't look over the windowsill. No, not even if they stood on tiptoe.
The room was deathly still. Matt heard a dove calling from the roof of the hospital. No hope, it said. No hope. No hope.
During the following years, each of my 5 brothers died. 2 drowned, 1 had a burst appendix, and we had no money for the doctor. The last 2 brothers were beaten to death by the police. There were 8 of us, said El Patrón, and only I lived to grow up. Don't you think I'm owed those lives?
El Patrón spoke so sharply Matt jolted up in his chair. The story wasn't ending the way he'd expected.
There were 8 of us, the old man cried. We should have all grown up, but I was the only survivor. I am meant to have those lives. I am meant to have justice.
Matt tried to stand. He was shoved back down by the bodyguards.
Justice, said Celia.
It was the first word she had spoken.
You know what it was like,
El Patrón whispered, his strength deserting him now after his outburst.
You came from the same village.
You've had many lives, Celia said. 1,000s of them are buried under the poppy fields.
Oh, them,
El Patrón was dismissive.
They're like cattle running after greener grass. They scuttle north and south across my fields. Oh, yes,
he said when Matt raised his eyebrows.
In the beginning, the tide was all one way. The Aztlanos ran north to find the big Hollywood lifestyle. But the United States isn't the rich paradise it once was. Now the Americanos look at movies about Aztlan and think life is pretty sweet down there. I catch about as many going one way as the other.
El Viejo was the only good man in this family, said Celia. He accepted what God gave him. And when God told him it was time to go, he did it.
Matt was amazed by her courage. People didn't argue with El Patrón if they wanted to stay healthy.
El Viejo was a fool,
whispered El Patrón. For a few moments, he stopped speaking. A doctor came in and listened to his heart. He gave him an injection.
The operating room is ready,
the doctor said in a low voice. Matt was swept by an icy wave of terror.
Not yet, murmured the old man.
10 more minutes, said the doctor.
El Patrón seemed to gather his strength for a last effort.
I created you, mi vida, as God created Adam.
Celia sniffed indignantly.
Without me, you would never have seen a beautiful sunset or smelled the rain approaching on the wind. You would never have tasted cool water on a hot summer day, or heard music, or known the wonderful pleasure of creating it. I gave you these things, mi vida. You owe me.
He owes you nothing, Celia said.
Matt was afraid for her.
El Patrón was capable of destroying a person who angered him. But the old man merely smiled.
We make a fine pair of scorpions, don't we?
Speak for yourself, said Celia. Matt owes you nothing, and he's going to pay you nothing. You can't use him for transplants.
The guards stirred when they heard this. The doctor looked up from the monitor he was watching.
When you had your first heart attack, I poisoned Matt with foxglove from my garden, said Celia. I'm a curandera, you know, as well as a cook. I made Matt's heart too unstable to transplant.
El Patrón's eyes bulged. He opened his mouth, but nothing came out. The doctor rushed to his side.
I couldn't keep on giving Matt foxglove, though. It's much too dangerous. I needed something that would make him sick, but not too sick. Then someone told me about monarch butterflies.
Matt sat up, only to have a bodyguard's hands tighten on his shoulders. He knew about the monarchs. Tamlin had talked about them in the garden, the night of Matt's coming-of-age celebration. The air had been heavy with perfumes, some pleasant, some not, from the flowers Celia had become interested in. She'd pointed out the black-eyed Susans, larkspur, foxgloves, and milkweed, and Tamlin was stirred when she'd mentioned milkweed.
It's fed upon by monarch butterflies, he'd said. They're clever little buggers. Fill themselves up with poison so nothing will eat them.
Matt had paid no attention to this remark at the time. Tamlin was always coming up with facts he got out of the nature books he read so slowly and carefully.
I needed something like the poison in monarch butterflies, said Celia, breaking into Matt's thoughts. So I began feeding him arsenic.
Arsenic? The doctor cried.
Arsenic creeps into the whole body, Celia went on, her eyes as cold as the eyes of a snake. It grows into the hair. It makes little white lines on the fingernails. It settles into the heart. I didn't give Matt enough to kill him. I wouldn't do that. But enough to kill anyone already weak who tried to steal his heart. You've had your 8 lives, El Patrón. It's time to make your peace with God.
Bruja! Witch!
Shrieked El Patrón. His eyes flamed with murderous rage. His skin flushed an angry red. He struggled to claw his way up from the bed.
Emergency! Yelled the doctor. Take him to the operating room! Move! Move! Move!
The guards rolled the bed away. The doctor ran beside it, pushing on El Patrón's chest. Suddenly, the whole building seethed like a wasp nest. More guards appeared, an army of them. Two of them hurried Celia off in spite of Matt's attempts to stop them. A technician snipped off a strand of Matt's hair and retreated. He was alone. Alone, that is, except for 4 burly men who sat outside the window and an unknown number lurking outside the door. It was a beautiful room, with a carpet patterned in the colors of the oasis. Matt saw the red of canyon walls, the heavy green of creosote, and a blue that was the color of the sky trapped between high cliffs. If he half-closed his eyes, he could almost imagine himself there, in the quiet shadows of the Ajo Mountains. He waited. It had been morning when El Patrón was wheeled out. Now it was afternoon. The panic had died down outside and the halls were nearly silent. The hospital went about its business without involving the prisoner in the elegant drawing room. Matt finished the tea and ate all the cookies. He felt utterly exhausted. Everything had been turned upside down, and he didn't know whether El Patrón's death would mean safety or exactly the opposite. Matt studied his arm and wondered at the arsenic that lurked inside. Would mosquitoes die if they bit him? Could he kill things by spitting on them? It was an interesting thought. Matt discovered that no matter how terrified he'd been at first, it wasn't possible to stay terrified. It was as though his brain said, okay, that's enough, let's find something else to do. Matt thought about Maria instead. She was probably back at the convent. He didn't know what she did there, aside from eating chocolates and sunbathing naked on the roof. What a crazy thing to do. What an interesting thing to do. Matt's face turned warm as he thought about it. He'd seen paintings of fat, naked goddesses from Rome in his art classes. He thought they were nice, but no one ran around like that in real life. Or did they?
He didn't know how people behaved in the outside world. Anyhow, Maria had gotten into trouble for it. Matt felt feverish, but it wasn't surprising, being full of arsenic as he was. He wondered what other stuff Celia had tried on him from her garden. The door swung open. Mr. Alacrán strode in with Tamlin. For an instant, time froze. Matt was 6 years old again, lying in a pool of blood, with Rosa plucking fragments of glass from his foot. A fierce man had burst into the room and shouted, "How dare you defile this house! Take the creature outside, now!" It was the first time Matt had realized he wasn't human. The fierce man had been Mr. Alacrán, and he had the same expression of loathing on his face now as he looked at Matt. "I'm here to inform you we no longer need your services," Mr. Alacrán said. Matt gasped. That meant El Patrón was dead. No matter how often he'd thought about it, the reality came as a blow. I'm sorry. Silent tears began to roll down Matt's face. He could keep himself from blubbering, but there was nothing he could do about the grief that welled up inside. "I imagine you are," said Mr. Alacrán. "It means we no longer have a use for you." "Of course you have a use for me," Matt thought. He knew as much about running opium as Stephen. He'd studied the farming techniques, the day-to-day problems of water purification and food distribution. He probably knew more than anyone about the network of spies and corrupt officials in other countries. Years of listening to El Patrón had given Matt a feel for the Alacrán Empire no one else could possibly have. "Have it put to sleep," Mr. Alacrán said to Tamlin. "Yes, sir," said Tamlin.
"What do you mean?" cried Matt. "El Patrón wouldn't want that. He had me educated. He wanted me to help run the country."
Tamlin looked at him in pity.
"You poor fool. El Patrón had 7 other clones exactly like you, each one educated and believing he was going to run the country."
"I don't believe it."
"I have to admit, you were the first one with musical genius, but we can always turn on the radio if we want that."
"You can't do this. We're friends. You said so. You left me a note."
Matt was knocked down by a blow that made him see stars. No one had ever struck him. No one was allowed to. He crawled to his knees, holding his jaw. He was even more shocked by the person who'd done it. Tamlin. Tamlin was an ex-terrorist. He'd been responsible for the deaths of 20 children, and maybe it didn't even bother him. Matt had never considered that possibility.
"You see, lad, I'm what you call a mercenary," said Tamlin in the lilting voice Matt had come to love. "I worked for El Patrón for donkey's years, thought he'd go on forever. But now I'm out of a job, and Mr. Alacrán has been kind enough to offer me another."
"What about Celia?" whispered Matt.
"You don't think she'd get away with the game she played? By now, she'll have been turned into an idiot."
"But you told her about the monarch butterflies," thought Matt. "You let her walk into the trap."
"Can you finish up here? I've got work to do," said Mr. Alacrán.
"I'll dispose of the clones, sir," said Tamlin. "I might need Daft Donald to help me tie it up."
He called me a clone, Matt thought. He called me an it.
"Remember, I want you back for the wake tonight," said Mr. Alacrán.
"Wouldn't miss it for the world," said Tamlin, with a twinkle in his lying, treacherous eyes.
Chapter 24. A Final Goodbye. Daft Donald held Matt firmly, and Tamlin wrapped him in duct tape. The bodyguard slung him over a horse as he exchanged greetings with other members of El Patrón's private army, lounging by the stables.
"Where are you taking it?" a man called.
"Thought I'd dump it next to the Egypt pens," Tamlin replied.
The man's laughter was lost in the drum of horses' hooves striking the earth. This animal was different from the safe horses. It was faster and less predictable. It even smelled different. Matt, with his nose pressed into its hide, was in a good position to know. Safe horses had a faint chemical odor, but this one reeked of sun and sweat. Matt suddenly realized what Tamlin meant by dumping him next to the Egypt pens. He was going to be thrown into the yellow ooze at the bottom of a pit. The horror of it,
The unfairness and treachery of almost everyone he'd ever known made Matt's blood pound in his ears. But this time, instead of fear, he felt a surge of pure animal rage. He deserved to live. He was owed this life that had so casually been given him. And if he had to die, he would struggle until the very last minute. Matt tested the tape holding his arms and legs. He couldn't move an inch. Well then, Matt thought, I'll have to wriggle and squirm my way out of the sludge pit. He saw the earth fly under the horse's hooves. His stomach bounced painfully against its body. This creature didn't run as smoothly as a safe horse. Finally, it slowed, and Tam Lin lifted Matt down. The boy managed to jackknife his body and drive his head into the man's stomach.
"Ah, you pea-brain ninny," swore Tam Lin. "Look about you before you do a stupid trick like that."
Matt rolled onto his back, his feet up to deliver a kick. He saw blue sky and a shoulder of rock. He smelled not slime and corruption, but good, clean air scented by creosote. They weren't by the Egypt pens. They were on the path to the Aho Mountains.
"There, I hope to have a lavish apology,"
grunted Tam Lin, peeling the tape none too gently off Matt's skin. "Are you going to drown me in the oasis instead?" Matt snarled.
"Get a grip on yourself, lad. All right, I can see you've got grounds for suspicion, but credit me with a little decency."
"How can I trust someone who killed 20 children?" Matt said.
"So, they told you that?"
Tam Lin looked so sad, Matt felt slightly, but only slightly, sorry for him. "Is it true?" he demanded.
"Oh, aye, it's true."
Tam Lin wadded the tape into a ball and stuffed it into one of the horse's saddlebags. He took out a backpack and heaved it over his shoulder.
"Come on, I don't have much time."
He started up the trail, not looking back. Matt paused. He could steal the horse and ride north. The farm patrol might not know yet that he was marked for disposal. Disposal, Matt thought with a glow of anger. But the animal didn't look easy to ride. Unlike a safe horse, it had to be tied to a tree. It rolled its eyes and flared its nostrils when Matt tried to get near it. On the other hand, he could follow Tam Lin into the mountains and hope the man's friendship held. Tam Lin had disappeared among the rocks. He wasn't even bothering to see whether Matt followed.
"I'm probably the world's biggest idiot," thought Matt as he trudged along the trail.
The oasis was brimming. Fall rains had brought life to the Palo Verde trees, making them bright with delicate yellow and orange flowers. The grape arbor was leafier than Matt ever remembered, and a small duck paddled away across the water as he approached. Tam Lin was perched on a rock.
"That's a cinnamon teal," he said. "They migrate from the United States to Aztlan this time of year. You wonder how they find a speck of water like this in all the dry desert."
Matt settled on another rock, not too near. The sun was sliding behind the hills and shadows crept into the little valley.
"If it hadn't been for this place, I'd have run barking mad years ago," the bodyguard said.
Matt watched the little duck work its way along the far shore.
"I was half mad when I went to work for El Patron. It's a place to hide, I thought then. I'll leave when the police get tired of hunting for me. But of course, things didn't work out that way. Once something belongs to El Patron, it's his forever."
"So you did kill the children," Matt said.
"I could say it was an accident, and it was, but that doesn't take away the horror. I was intending to blow up the Prime Minister, a fat toad who deserved it. I simply never considered the other people who might get in the way. Frankly, I was such a self-important ass, I didn't care. I got most of these scars from that explosion, and Daft Donald had his throat cut. That's why he can't talk."
In all these years, Matt hadn't thought about why Daft Donald never spoke. He'd assumed the large, silent man was antisocial.
"El Patron had an instinct for people he could enslave," said Tam Lin. "He was such a powerful presence."
"Power's a strange thing, lad. It's a drug, and people like me crave it. It wasn't till I met Celia that I saw what a monster I'd become. I was too happy swaggering around in El Patron's shadow."
"But you let the doctors turn Celia into an Egypt," said Matt.
"I did not. I marked her forehead so it appeared like she was operated on. I put her in the stables with Rosa."
Matt looked at Tamlin directly for the first time since they arrived at the Oasis. A great weight shifted off his chest.
She'll be safe as long as she remembers to act like a zombie.
So now, I think I've earned that lavish apology, the bodyguard said.
And Matt gave it, at great length and wholeheartedly.
I would have brought her here, but Celia isn't much for climbing rocks, Tamlin sighed.
They looked out over the pool with the afternoon sky silvering its surface. The cinnamon teal waddled onto the bank and preened its feathers. A swallow scooped up a dragonfly hovering over the water.
Am I supposed to live here? Matt asked.
Tamlin started.
Ah, my mind was wandering. I love the way swallows turn just before they're about to crash into the ground.
No, lad, you wouldn't be able to survive. It's better if you go to Aztlan.
Aztlan?
Matt's heart gave a bound.
Are you coming with me?
I can't.
Tamlin's voice was sad.
You see, I've done terrible things in my life, and I can't escape the consequences.
That's not true, Matt said. The police probably stopped looking for you long ago. You could give people a false name. You could grow a beard and shave your head.
Of course I could. And may I say, you're showing quite a lawless streak. Quite a chip off the old block you are.
No, I'm talking about moral consequences. I've spent years benefiting from the horrors of opium, and now I have the chance to put things right. I mustn't pass it up. Celia has made me see that. She's a very strict woman, you know. Won't put up with evil.
I know, said Matt, thinking of how Celia had stood up to El Padrón.
I've already packed your bag, Tamlin said, unslinging the backpack. There's maps in the chest. Take as many water bottles as you can manage, and when you reach the Aztlan border, say you're a refugee. Your parents have been taken by the farm patrol. Act stupid. That shouldn't be a problem. And don't tell anyone you're a clone.
Won't they be able to tell? Matt imagined the Aztlanos' rage when they realized they'd been duped.
Here's the dirty little secret.
Tamlin bent down and whispered, as though he had to hide the information from the swallows, the ducks, and the dragonflies.
No one can tell the difference between a clone and a human. That's because there isn't any difference. The idea of clones being inferior is a filthy lie.
Tamlin strode off to the metal chest, leaving Matt open-mouthed. He watched the man remove water bottles and maps.
How could a clone be the same as a human? Everything in Matt's experience argued against it.
Tamlin unzipped a pocket in the backpack and took out a clump of paper.
This is money. See, I should have taught you about it before. Here's a 100-peso note, and here's a 50. Always ask the price of something first and offer half. Oh, crikey, you're not going to learn it now. Just remember to take out one piece of paper at a time, and don't let anyone see how many pieces of paper you have.
The sun had set, and dusk was falling rapidly. Tamlin built a fire and stacked dry wood nearby.
You should go first thing in the morning. That gives you 12 hours to reach the border. It's the ideal time, because the farm patrol is at the house for the wake. Another thing. El Patrón has kept opium frozen 100 years in the past.
I don't understand, said Matt.
Opium, as much as possible, is the way things were in El Patrón's youth. Celia cooks on a wood fire. The rooms aren't air-conditioned. The fields are harvested by people, not machines. Even rockets aren't allowed to fly over. The only places where the rules are relaxed are the hospital and the security system. It was El Patrón's way of outwitting death.
One of his ways.
But everything's the same on TV, Matt protested.
Tamlin laughed.
El Patrón controlled that too.
El Látigo Negro snapped his last whip a century ago. Talk about reruns.
In many ways, you'll find Aztlan confusing. But they've had a movement back to simpler times recently. They're trying to turn away from a machine-based economy to the old Mexican culture. You'll find something familiar.
Wait, cried Matt as the bodyguard made ready to leave.
Can't you stay?
The thought of losing his friend and perhaps never seeing him again was devastating.
I've got to attend the wake, said Tamlin.
Then bring Celia here. I could help her climb the rocks.
Where do you see the rocks?
No, lad. Celia's too old to make the trip. I'll keep her as safe as I can. You have my word on it.
What should I do in Aztlan? Where can I stay? Matt was beginning to feel panicky.
Where's my head? Tamlin said, stopping at the edge of the firelight. I left the most important thing out.
The first thing you do in Atlan is catch a hovercraft to San Luis and ask directions to the convent of Santa Clara. Unless I'm very much mistaken, Maria will dance rings around you when you walk in the front door.
There was no stopping him this time. Tamlin strode ahead with Matt trotting behind. When they reached the hole in the rock, the bodyguard turned and put his hand on Matt's shoulder.
I don't believe in long goodbyes, he said.
Will I ever see you again? Tamlin waited a moment before saying,
No.
Matt drew in his breath sharply.
I've never lied to you, and I don't intend to start now. The important thing is, you've escaped. You're the one possession El Patron let slip through his fingers.
What's going to happen to me? Matt said.
You're going to find Maria, and, if things work out, her mother.
You know Esperanza?
Oh, aye. She used to come to the house. Did you ever see that movie about dinosaurs? The one with the Velociraptor?
Matt remembered a particularly nasty dinosaur with long claws and teeth and a willingness to burrow through rock to get at its prey.
Well, that's Esperanza when she's got a cause. She's a good person to have on your side.
Tamlin climbed through the rock and went off into the gathering dark.
He didn't look back.
Matt kept himself from shining the flashlight on him. Chapter 25. The Farm Patrol. Matt felt almost lightheaded as he walked back to the oasis. So much had happened so quickly. So much had changed. The little campfire seemed unbearably lonely. He built up the fire and then worried about whether the farm patrol could see it. He kicked some of the branches away. Then Matt thought about the animals that might come to the water at night. Coyotes for sure. A bobcat maybe. A jaguar was a long shot, but Tamlin had seen them. Matt built up the fire again. He found beef jerky and dried apples in the metal chest. He was ravenous, having eaten nothing but cookies since the morning of the wedding. The food lifted his spirits, and soon he was poring over the map in the flickering light. It was like an exciting novel full of possible adventures. Tamlin had marked the route with a red pen and added comments using his own creative spelling, such as rattlesnakes here and saw bear under tree. Matt finished dinner with a handful of peanuts and a chocolate bar. He shut the backpack into the metal chest and unrolled the sleeping bag on an exposed slab of rock. He felt safer away from places where he might meet bear under tree. Then he lay down and looked at the stars. It was oddly frightening to lie on the ground without a shelter. The sky was so black and the stars so many and brilliant. He might lose his hold on the earth. He'd float away, and if he didn't grab a tree branch, he'd go on forever into those bright, inhuman lights. Matt ran a rope from the sleeping bag to a tree. Okay, it was a dumb thing to worry about, but it didn't hurt to be careful. Celia once told him the Indians in her village carried charms to keep from being carried off by the sky. They might know something people with houses didn't understand. Exhausted by all that had happened, Matt fell into a deep and dreamless sleep. Just before dawn, the air vibrated with something that was almost, but not quite, a sound. Matt sat up and grabbed the rope. The ground shivered briefly and was still. A pair of ravens exploded off a tree branch and flew around the oasis, cawing wildly. A coyote froze with its muzzle dripping from the pool where it had been drinking. Matt listened. The sound, if it was a sound, had come from all around. It wasn't like anything he'd experienced. The ravens settled, grumbling between themselves, and the coyote bolted into the rocks. Matt started a fire with a lighter he found in the backpack. He saw that the metal chest was ringed with coyote prints, and something had tried to gnaw the latch. After a quick breakfast, he filled as many water bottles as he could carry, placing an iodine tablet in each one. The last time he drank oasis water, he'd been deathly sick. But that was the arsenic, he realized. How was Celia, he wondered. Would she get enough to eat in the stables? And wasn't acting like a zombie as bad as being one if you had to do it for years? I'll ask Esperanza to help her escape, he thought.
Now that the moment for departure had come, Matt found himself dawdling. He double-checked the